She never told her love, but let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love, indeed?
A reading life, a writing life, with writer and teacher Sally Bailey. Produced by Andrew Smith.
Very loud siren going by this morning over Donington Bridge Road. Very loud indeed. The sound of a siren can make one feel as though you're in a city, and of course I am, technically speaking, in a city, but on the edge of one. Sound carries across the water. And my neighbour told me yesterday of a near drowning by the weir this weekend. It's nearly the season for swimming in the river. The river's still flowing too fast, though, really, to get in. But there were two men in a dinghy. They came past my boat, too. I saw them turning round and around like the owl and the pussycat. I wasn't sure they knew what they were doing. They then got stuck and they could not get back upstream. I think things went a bit awry, according to my neighbour. In fact, one of them couldn't swim, which is not a good idea if you're messing about on the river in a dinghy with a fast flow. No, no. So, I am giving them my disapproving look from here this morning, my boat. One should not mess about on the river unless one can swim. Now today, I'm going to see some bluebells. I'm going up to Boar's Hill, where my friend Philip used to live. Dear Philip. Dear Philip. I will say a prayer for Philip in the woods in Boar's Hill. He used to go walking there. He would have sent me some messages by this time of year about the bluebells and the wood anemones and the sticklewort, and all such wonderful gems and jewels underneath the trees. Philip, the tree man. So I'm reading The Girl of Slender Means by Muriel Spark. Muriel Spark is one of my favourite novelists. Her wit is beyond compare, and her sense of an era too. A Girl of Slender Means was published in 1963. Muriel Spark was really in her heyday in the 60s, and this novel is set in a belated sense back in the war period. She's writing of the end of the Second World War, 1945, and it has one of the most splendidly funny openings, I think, of any 20th century novel. Long ago in 1945, all the nice people in England were poor, allowing for exceptions. The streets of the cities were lined with buildings in bad repair, or in no repair at all. Bomb sites piled with stony rubble, houses like giant teeth, in which decay had been drilled out, leaving only the cavity. all the nice people were poor. At least, that was a general axiom. The best of the rich being poor in spirit. Quite wonderful. Muriel Spark was very influenced by the border ballads, Walter Scott's Minstrelsy. So it has this rhythm that I'm not quite getting yet. I haven't quite got myself on my rhythmic horse, not quite trotting or galloping along as I ought to be. It's a tale, of course, it's a fairy tale, and she's ripping apart our sense of what is nice and what is not nice. People continue to exchange assurances of depressed feelings about the weather or the news or the Albert Memorial, which had not been hit, not even shaken, by any bomb, from first to last. Then enters a central focus, the main building, the main site, which has not been bombed either. The May of Tech Club stood obliquely opposite the site of the memorial, in one of a row of tall houses which had endured, but barely. And this boarding house, which reads to me very much like a poor girl's boarding school, but it is in fact a boarding house of some kind. It's a club. The May of Tech Club exists for the pecuniary convenience and social protection of ladies of slender means, below the age of 30 years. These girls are living scattered across the rooms of the May Tech Club, or the May of Tech Club. It sounds like some ancient order of priestess or nun. And the substance of Muriel Spark's book is really the decay of the material world, London, and how that relates to being poor, and yet how the spirit of those who are poor still cling to a sense of style, which is exactly how Spark herself writes. She is the most stylish of writers. And this very slim book, this very slender book, The Girls of Slender Means, is really a romance or a romantic letter or valentine to her time spent in London in the after-war period, when she worked in various jobs as a secretary, but also after some time, having made her name as a poet in London, she was in fact the editor of the Poetry Review, which was then the most illustrious poetry journal in Britain. And having gone to the National Library of Scotland, where her papers are kept, I know quite a lot about Muriel Spark and her saucy wit and her way of, let's just say, engineering people to put them in the right place to her advantage. And there's a lot of that kind of social negotiation going on in Girl of Slender Means. But at the heart of this novella is an investigation into what keeps us going, what keeps our spirits going when we are poor, when we are in pecuniary circumstances. What keeps us going? What lifts us? What feeds us? What do we do for fun and play? Where does our wit come from? How is our wit sourced when we might be perhaps low in spirit and low on pennies? Love and money were the vital themes in all the bedrooms and dormitories. Beautiful line. It's the opening of chapter 3. Love and money were the vital themes in all the bedrooms and dormitories. You can hear there her tradition of ballad. The balladic form, the rhyme, the sing-song. And I'm very aware as I'm reading this how hard my mouth is working to sound out the rounded sounds, the vowel sounds. Very, very strong on vowels. This is a book that needs to be read aloud, as does all poetry. Love came first, and subsidiary to it was money, for the upkeep of looks and the purchase of clothing coupons at the official black market price of 8 coupons for £1. And so forth and so on, we explore the details of these girls' daily lives, led floor to floor, wall to wall. On the floor above that, there seemed to have congregated, by instinctive consent, most of the celibates. The way she here describes plural nouns, the way she's naming the old maids, and the way she's apportioning character to them. Of settled character and various ages, those who had decided on a spinster's life, comma, pause, and those who would one day do so, but had not yet discerned the fact for themselves. Well, rather uncompromising paragraph. It's rather terrifying, actually. Full of judgment, full of final judgment. Spark can be a very cruel writer. Her writing is very compressed and very spare. This idea of a life that is already determined, a kind of fatalism, that these women will be locked into this May of Tech Club for the rest of their lives. For the rest of their lives. So she goes through the building in this manner, and she counts the rooms and she counts the number of spaces, and there's a mathematics of space. At the top of the house, on the fourth floor, the most attractive, sophisticated and lively girls had their rooms. They were filled with deeper and deeper social longings of various kinds, as peacetime crept over everyone. One was almost engaged to be married, and the other was Jane Wright. Fat, but intellectually glamorous, by virtue of the fact that she worked for a publisher. She was on the lookout for a husband, meanwhile being mixed up with young intellectuals. What I love about these paragraphs, they're taut and tight, but the way that she creates a universe of feminine taxonomies, types of girls, all so wittily and so humorously. They're also tiny miniature biographies of character. And Spark has taught me how to do that. Don't be afraid of creating miniature biographies as you pass through your characters. If you don't do so, your reader will forget who it is you're speaking of. She was also herself a biographer, Muriel Spark, so her particular gift is for these kinds of biographical summaries. They're rather damning, of course. Poor Jane Wright is rather damned here, as are our spinsters on the floor below. And each of these women is described by some kind of attire, some kind of dress, as though their character, like their dress, is passing through a particular mode of appearance and mode in time, a fashion which will exist for a while and then be dismissed very cruelly, as indeed are their lives. Now, the other reason I'm perhaps reading The Girls of Slender Means at the moment by Muriel Spark is because I'm thinking of my own life and the fact that I live on very little. I currently have no salary, and I haven't had a salary for decades. I've only ever had temporary salaries for a term here or there. Short-term contracts, what we now call zero-hour contracts, where one gets paid only by the hour, or to cover somebody for a semester or a term or two in a university, or in this case in a college within the Oxford system, the collegiate system. Now I only work on my own terms as a freelance tutor and writer and mentor, but I get paid only by the hour, and currently, because of my state of health, I can only work about 2 to 4 hours a week. And perhaps rather sadly or awkwardly, I'm now living on what is called the Personal Independence Payment Scheme, which is awarded to those who have a serious disability, which I currently do. Which means I'm also one of the girls of slender means. So yes, I'm reading this book during a time of austerity. We're being told this is an austere era. And indeed, 1945, which is the year this book is set in, was another austere era. And the girls of slender means are labelled as such by Spark and by Spark's narrator. Indeed, that's the premise for this novel. And the question Spark asks is, what feeds our spirit? How do we get our wit? How do we make wit? How do we keep our intelligence alive? What are the idioms one might employ? Those of us who live slenderly. Another glorious character from Spark's The Girls of Slender Means, Joanna Child, with an E on the end. Joanna Child was giving elocution lessons to Miss Harper, the cook, in the recreation room. A wonderful piece of snobbery and class challenge here. Joanna's method was to read each stanza herself first and make her pupil repeat it. So enter poetry. Muriel Spark was very invested in poetry. It was her first form. And she ran several journals where she was in charge of the poetry submissions and decisions over submissions, including the Poetry Review in London. Everyone in the drawing room could hear the loud lesson in progress, beating out the stresses and throbs of the wreck of the Deutschland. The frown of his face before me, the hurtle of hell behind. Where was a place? I recognise Joanna Child as a kind of young spinster archetype who chucks up her head and recites poetry. And I can feel my diaphragm opening and closing as I read those poetic lines. And I think Muriel Spark includes those in her novels because she needs to be reminded of narrative thrust. But also to have that sense of movement through the body, that visceral expansion and contraction of air, that shaft or that draft of air coming down through your body, which of course is the business of recitation and elocution and rhetoric, all those operations, which is to say drawing in breath through the body and releasing it slowly like this. And indeed, this was the kind of education that I had. Again, I also had elocution lessons in the 80s. God knows where we got the money from, but we did. My mother was expert at getting things for free or at reduced prices, or through some kind of strange negotiation of one kind or another, which allowed for this strange bird-like lady to appear in our midst, in our front room, from Pagham Bay. Her name was Miss Rutherford, or Mrs. Rutherford, as in Margaret Rutherford, the actress. She was tiny and diminutive, a little robin or a little wren, hopping around our front room, and she taught me speeches. She taught me to fling my arms wide and to chuck up my head like Joanna Child as I spoke out loud to the cornices of our Victorian house by the sea the words of Shakespeare. In particular, I remember speeches by Viola from Twelfth Night. She never told her love, but let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love, indeed? I'm looking at the light on the ceiling in my boat this morning, a shimmering, opalescent, yellow field. White, yellow, turning to dark brown round the edges, a field of light, shimmering and shimmering away. And it reminds me of the time when I used to practice my elocution with Miss Rutherford. Miss Rutherford, who taught me how to speak up and out to the ceiling and the cornices, to fling my arms wide open, as though I were receiving home a long-lost sailor, I used to imagine. Because everything in Shakespeare, which I was then declaiming to the ceiling, was about love. Everything was about love then. I want to touch that yellow lozenge on the ceiling. A small circle of light above my head. It moves across the boat every morning when the sun is out. It's really very beautiful indeed. It's calling me outside. It's calling me through the ceiling. And I think of Miss Rutherford. That small bird hop, hop, hopping up on top of my boat through the ceiling. Everything in Miss Rutherford's world was about the diaphragm, the rising and falling of breath, the smoothness of breath, and the roundness of my mouth as it opened as I spoke. Hey now, brown cow. That is the microphone on the ceiling, touching my vowels, which have risen. Up, 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 said Miss Rutherford, up. Open your lungs, up, your mouth out and wide. Think of it, dear, as something like a piece of elastic. Up, 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 send your vowels up to the ceiling. And that, my dears, is the ceiling. So, Muriel Spark, a wonderful writer of time. Time set against the backdrop of war, where things happen differently, with more rapidity and acceleration, where love and intimacy and friendships are counted in a different sort of way. I read Spark to understand how to write up time, various strands of time, time ribboning along on different levels. The weeks had passed, and since, in the May of Tech Club, they were weeks of youth in the ethos of war, they were capable of accommodating quick happenings and reversals, rapid formations of intimate friendships, and a range of lost and discovered loves that in later life and in peace would take years to happen. Grow and fade. It's a beautiful elegiac sentence for various strands of time. The weeks had passed, that's calendrical time, the time you might mark off on the calendar, comma. And since in the May of Tech Club they were weeks of youth in the ethos of war, so a different kind of counting of weeks, they are the weeks of young people. All of these people are young, and they are coming of age at the end of a great war, the Second World War. They were capable of accommodating quick happenings and reversals. So that's the time of affection and love and emotion, in which anything can suddenly turn around. I love you. I hate you. Go away. Rapid formations of intimate friendships and a range of lost and discovered loves. So in other words, the timing of feeling, if you like, the emotional pulse of young people falling in love and then realizing they've made a mistake. I got up onto the roof with him and I realized I didn't really like him anymore. That kind of thing. Quick happenings and reversals, rapid formations of intimate friendships, going to bed with someone you never normally would, but against the ethos of war, you never know how much longer you might have before a bomb drops. And a range of lost and discovered loves. So the final part of the sentence, Spark, moves us out of the rapid formations where we imagine something a bit more transient, foolish, experimental, quick happenings and reversals, to a longer range of time after the war. Beyond youth, the middle years of life, perhaps even the latter years of life, where you begin to reflect upon what it was you did and who you were and who you were with when you were young. A range of lost and discovered loves that in later life and in peace would take years to happen, grow and fade. This beautiful sense of time expanding and slowing down once one is out of the heat of young passion, and of rapid changes of feelings about one or another person you may have happened to have gone to bed with and then realised you'd made a mistake. That sort of scattering of feeling that you undertake when you're young, impulsive, hot-headed, moody, temperamental, without realising, without passing proper judgment, without discerning who it is you might perhaps be kissing. Making a fool of yourself, choosing the wrong man, having a drink, having another drink, kissing him, the next morning realising he looks a bit like a frog, that sort of thing. And the upshot of all of this is a great deal of absurdity. Very human.
Thank you for listening to A Reading Life, A Writing Life, with writer and teacher Sally Bailey, produced by Andrew Smith. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like it, give us a review, or mention us to friends or on social media. Thank you.